Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello, and welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, with you today. Well, here it is. It's August of 2015, and typically not much happens in financial markets in August. You know, everybody's out on vacation or something. Except this year, vacations are probably being ruined. Oil has re-plunged to new lows for the move. Dr. Copper has plunged through support to lows not seen since, you guessed it, the fateful year of 2009. In fact, the entire commodity complex, including silver and gold, has entered profound bear territory. China has been all over the news, notably because of its stock market bubble bursting and the official rescue efforts, but less notably for a smart decline in both exports and imports. Central bankers the world over are saying that everything is fine and they have it all under control, but their actions say otherwise. To help us make sense of all this, we welcome back one of my very favorite guests, Dr. Mark Faber. Dr. Faber was born in Zurich, Switzerland, and now has an office in Hong Kong. He publishes a really very widely read monthly investment newsletter, The Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, which highlights unusual investment opportunities, and he is the author of several books, including Tomorrow's Gold, Asia's Age of Discovery, published in 2002, right at the beginning of the Age of Discovery there. And speaking of timing, in 1987, he warned his clients to cash out before Black Monday on Wall Street. He made them handsome profits by forecasting the burst of the Japanese bubble in 1990, correctly predicted the collapse in the U.S. gaming stocks in 1993, and, well, he's just been ahead of the curve every step of the way. Welcome, Mark.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for having me on your program.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, okay, let's talk economy first, market second, central bank actions third, and then predictions fourth. So, how do you see the global economy right now?
Well, contrary to many observers and strategists and economists, I don't believe that the global economy is healing, but I believe that the global economy is heading into a slump once again. We have a slowdown practically everywhere. And if you take out the fudging of statistics, the economy for the median household everywhere in the world is not doing particularly well. If the global economy was doing so fantastically well, how would it be that commodities collapsed to the extent that they've declined? Or how would it be that the currencies of emerging markets, and some of them have actually declined by more than 50% against the US dollar in the last 3 years. How would this happen? So I don't believe that we have a healing of the global economy. On the contrary, I believe that the global economy is slowing down and that essentially equity markets are not particularly attractive.
Now, on this global slowdown, obviously China has been the engine of growth, particularly with commodities, sucking up to half or more of certain key commodities. Let's talk about where China is, because I clearly think that's a key component of this whole story. Of course, certainly we've got their currency devaluation, which has the potential to export deflation out of the world. But let's start with their economy. I've read a statistic that says 50% of their GDP of the last 5 years was building things. So they went through an aggressive build-out phase, and that is clearly coming to some sort of an end, as it must. Is that how you see it? And if so, what does China do next?
Well, basically, preceding every bubble, you have a huge expansion of credit. That was the case in the period 97 to 2000, and in the period 2003 to 2007, and on previous occasions in economic history. In the case of China, credit as a percent of the economy has grown by more than 50% over the last 5 years, which is essentially a world record. And in my view, the economy is slowing down rapidly. I had a drink with a friend of mine the other day who has car dealerships, luxury car dealerships in China. He said sales have hit a brick wall, not slow down, a brick wall. And indeed, exports were down and car sales were down in July. So I think that this will then spill over again in other emerging economies, because China is a large buyer of commodities and a large trading partner to other countries. So I really believe that the emerging market complex is not doing well at the present time. And I travel extensively. I can see roughly what is going on. Everywhere, people basically are faced with rising costs of living and essentially declining currency, so the purchasing power goes down. So it's not a pretty picture.
Well, if we look particularly at, say, some of the RIM countries around there, Indonesia, Malaysia, their currencies have taken a huge hit. So even though commodities have come down, if you're importing those commodities and your currency goes down, you're still maybe spending more. Is that what you mean by rising prices for, say, people in those two countries?
Well, basically, some of these countries, whether it's Malaysia or Thailand or Jakarta, are exporting large quantities of raw materials, commodities such as agricultural commodities, copper, iron ore, coal, and so forth. And when prices collapse, these countries' revenues go down. At the same time, all these countries are large importers of goods, of manufactured goods. And so when the currency goes down and the manufactured goods are still coming in, these countries have to pay a higher price. So in my view, and we've seen that in Japan, basically Abenomics was supposed to boost personal incomes, but in fact, in real terms, disposable incomes in Japan on a per capita basis have been tumbling.
Well, monetary policy unfortunately picks winners and losers, so the exporters of Japan were anointed the winners in that story, I guess. Of course, the people have to be the losers on that front.
Well, they did well in yen terms, but not in dollar terms. In dollar terms, exports are either flat or down. But in yen terms, yes, they're up.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about oil, another key commodity here. I certainly didn't see that huge tumble that began a little over a year ago now. It looks like it's staying down at this point in time. What do you think is driving that?
Well, I mean, I believe the principal reason for the decline in oil prices is weakening global economy. The second reason is obviously the increased supply, mostly out of the U.S., coming from fracking and from alternate sources of energy. So the price has adjusted on the downside. Will it stay here, go lower or higher? Nobody knows precisely. My sense is that an equilibrium price for oil is between $40 and $60 a barrel. But can oil revisit the lows of 2008, December 2008, which were $32 a barrel, or even go lower? Yes, possible. But all this points to a global tightening of liquidity, a global tightening of liquidity. And if global liquidity tightens, it's not good for equity prices in general.
Well, now let's talk about that liquidity, because I want to get to the role of central banks here in all of this. Because obviously they've done heroic efforts to just have liquidity sloshing out of every possible corner. I think we've seen a lot of that in a variety of markets. But the central banks would like us to believe that they have everything under control. What I'm interested in is, what's your view of what they've really managed to accomplish here?
In my view, what central banks have done, notably the Federal Reserve, is A, create the Nasdaq bubble and then the collapse. And then they superimposed on the Nasdaq bubble and housing bubble, under the advice also of the neo-Keynesian like Krugman and so forth. And we know how it ended. It ended very badly. And then during the crisis in 2007-2008, they began a massive money printing exercise. And in a way, it is true that they saved at that time the financial system. The question is, was it worth saving, and were the costs justifiable? Now, since then, the global economy has not done particularly well. It's done well because of a huge stimulus package in China, and China contributed, I don't know, maybe 50% to global growth overall. But in general, in the U.S., the median household hasn't done well. But it saved the financial system. And in my view, now we have essentially 6 years of interest rates at 0%. And what has been achieved is preciously little. And as I said, in my view, the economy is slowing down. So what we may have had is a postponement of the problems. Don't forget, global debts as a percent of the global economy are now 30% higher than they were prior to the crisis in 2007.
Well, wasn't all this predicated? So the central banks really, I think they had their fingers double-crossed in this one. They were going to stimulate, they were going to provide liquidity, and then the global growth was supposed to come back to justify all their efforts. You're saying that growth isn't here, it doesn't justify their efforts. And now we have more debt than we had even in 2008.
Correct. And I would add to this. Everybody in business and in economics and in the financial service sector agrees that basically free markets are the best for economic growth. But here you have a bunch of professors and academics that sit in central banks that think that they can plan the global economy. And there's no currency war. There is a coordinated effort by central banks to essentially print money. And it's like in a relay race. The baton is passed from one central bank to another, and they all talk to each other every day, and one does this for a while, the U.S. prints money, then it goes to Japan, then it goes to the ECB, then it goes to China, and so forth. I mean, the whole thing is not going to work.
Well, devil's advocate, why not? They've gotten away with it for 6 years now.
Well, I want to tell you why not. Because an economy depends essentially for growth on productivity, and it depends on capital spending. That produces sustainable economic growth. And with money printing, you don't achieve that. And we have plenty of examples of countries that printed money. And what followed was a disaster, not strong and sustainable economic growth. It created bubbles, and then the bubbles burst and impoverished the majority, like the housing bubble has impoverished the majority of participants, young people. They lost their homes because they were encouraged to borrow money to buy homes, and then prices went down, so they lost their homes. And now they have to rent, and rents go up substantially. So they're stuffed actually not once, but twice.
Hmm. That's absolutely right. So as I look at what the central banks are doing, it looks like they're out of bullets. You know, they talk.
No, they're criminals.
All right. Well, I agree. They're not probably going to be held to account like good criminals, but what do you think they're going to do next year? Thinking like a criminal.
Well, look, that is a question I don't lose any sleep about, but I'm thinking about it a lot. Because in good English, being so deep in shit, I think they will have to continue to print money. It may not happen right away, but say, who knows, maybe the Fed was talking to the People's Bank of China and told them, why don't you now ease massively, and that gives us an excuse not to increase interest rates in September. Who knows?
Yeah, you're talking about a level of coordination and control. I mean, look, I've traded for a long time, and then trading became very difficult to do starting around 2008. I now understand, having looked at the work of Eric Hunsader out of Nanex and understanding how the high-frequency trading machines work, that there is a layer of control on this market that has nothing to do with fundamentals. It has to do with co-location of servers, microsecond timings, algorithms, all kinds of things. In my view, it seems to me that these computerized markets, they do provide really high liquidity, apparently. They do provide really low cost execution. They also provide maybe a variety of other benefits. But we've seen these astonishing flash crashes in everything, if as large as the U.S. dollar and the U.S. Treasury market, oil market, gold, you name it. Do you have any concerns about market structure at this point?
Well, basically, on the upside, there is always plenty of liquidity. How much liquidity there is, we will test when markets go down. Now, we tested that in emerging economies, and there wasn't that much liquidity. The markets went down, both currencies and stocks, like a stone. So, in the case of the U.S., this remains to be seen, how much true liquidity there is. As you know, also in the U.S., junk bonds, or in other words, high-yield bonds, have declined quite substantially. And some stocks, on bad news, they just opened 10-20% lower. So we'll see how the liquidity really works.
All right. Well. This is something that's really fascinating to me. And moving on to this market idea, then, because currently it looks like global equity, well, at least Western equity and bond markets, they've made entirely different bets on the future. Sovereign yields, representing safety, have plunged. High yield credit, as you just mentioned, has spiked in yields. Every dip, however, in the U.S., Europe, and Japanese stock markets gets bought. One of these two markets, equities and bonds, seems to have it dead wrong. Where do you place your money?
Well, I wished I knew precisely where to place my money. You understand? There are different asset classes in a system that is not rigged and where money supply and credit is tight. Cash is a safe investment, basically cash, either in treasury bills or with the banks. But in today's environment, where essentially cash doesn't give you any return, I'm not sure that over the next 10 years cash will be a desirable investment. That, as we discussed before, will depend very much on central banks' monetary policies. My sense is that cash, except for short periods of time, will not be a very desirable investment. And beyond that, we would have to decide, well, how do we keep cash in euros, in yen, in dollars? At the present time, as you know, the bullish consensus about the dollar is very high and everybody's very positive. But this has not always been the case. And the dollar at this level leads to U.S. industries being uncompetitive. So I'm not sure that the dollar will remain a strong currency forever. So cash is not safe. Bonds, I own U.S. government bonds, and by the way, I also own cash, because I think that the global economy is slowing down, and say here I see U.S. 10-year treasuries yielding 2.17%, but at the same time, 10-year French government bonds yield less than half as much, or even Italian government bonds yield less than U.S. treasuries, or Spanish government bonds yield less than U.S. bonds. So I'm saying to myself, maybe U.S. treasuries is not the worst investment. I don't like it because, say, you buy a 10-year treasury here, the maximum you can earn for the next 10 years is annually 2.18%. It's not a desirable return. But maybe it's better than many other things that will go down or go bankrupt. I also own some shares, mostly in Asia, and obviously this year, because of the depreciation of the currencies and the relatively poor performances of markets, they haven't done well this year. But over the longer term, they were good investments, and the valuations now are reasonable. They're not as low as at the trough of the market in 2009 or 2003, but they have come to a reasonable level where the expected return over the next 10 years in dollar terms may be around 4 or 5%. Then I own some real estate, and I own obviously some precious metals, because I want to be diversified in an environment where I have no clue where the world will be in 5 years' time.
Well, let's talk about those precious metals for a minute. You know, if you'd said to me 5 years ago, Chris, here's some data, and you showed me the amount of gold that's going into China, particularly India second, rest of Asia third, and noting that that's well over 100% of global mine output at this point, I would have been, I would have lost the bet, because I would have thought that fundamental data would have certainly been price supportive. Obviously, it hasn't been. I'd like to get your views on where, what's happening with the price of gold, whether that's just a paper market artifact or it's real, or how gold is really viewed in China. You being over in Hong Kong and also in Thailand area, how is Asia viewing gold? I know in the West, I can't crack the newspaper without somebody telling me it's a paperweight, a barbarous relic, or a pet rock.
Well, in general, whether it's Indonesia, India, or China, or any other Asian country, gold has always been a kind of a safe haven. And gold has always been bought because Asian currencies over the very long term have been relatively weak. So the culture of gold in Asia is probably more pronounced than, say, in the United States. But there are differences. In Korea, hardly anyone owns gold. In Japan, very few people own gold. But in China and in India and Vietnam and so forth, Indonesia, Malaysia, and even Hong Kong, they own a lot of gold, and they will continue to buy as well as other people in emerging economies. And I think if you ask me why did the price of gold decline, well, along with other commodities and along with a tightening global liquidity and along with the dollar strength, and also because between 2000, specifically 1999, and 2011, gold performed superbly, as well as silver. And so a meaningful correction is not extraordinary. We had in stocks in the 80s, in 87, a meaningful correction, 40% from peak to trough, and the bull market continued. So I'm not so concerned about this correction, and I'm always telling people, if gold indeed goes to $700-$800, as some experts seem to predict, I'd like to see where the Dow Jones is and the S&P.
With your prediction being?
Well, my sense would be that equities would be down very substantially, because then we're talking really about extreme tight global liquidity and a slump in economic activity, it would probably be good for treasuries for a while, not forever, but for a while, and negative for equity prices. Especially if you look at equity prices around the world, emerging equities emerging market equities are now reasonably priced. As I said, they're not cheap. Europe is reasonably priced, not quite as cheap as I would like to invest in Europe, but I have investments in European equities. And the US is in la-la land, because everybody says it's the least ugly sisters in the room. And yes, that may be the case, but because of that, the US dollar adjusted is also much more expensive than all the other markets.
Well, it's also seems to be a bulletproof market. You know, I used to say a double top was bad. A triple top was certainly something to catch your attention. But what are we on, a septuple top, an octuple top now in the S&P 500? It's just stuck.
Well, I don't know. The one thing I know is that essentially 50% of shares, or depending on the day, are now down below the 200-day moving average. In other words, they are lower than they were a year ago. And if I look at the list of new highs and new lows every day on the New York Stock Exchange, and the Nasdaq, by the way, recently, like in the last two trading days, Friday and Monday, the market went up. But the number of 12-month new lows on the New York Stock Exchange vastly exceeded the number of new highs. That tells you not all is well in the market. It's just being supported by very few shares.
And extremely low volume. So yes, the internals are ugly. The volume isn't good. There's not a lot to really love in this right now. So it doesn't seem like there's a lot of conviction. But
there's a lot of value.
Well, that's probably been true for a while.
And look, you take a share like General Motors. It's down almost 20% from its recent high with record sales. Partly because 35% of the sales are in China and almost 50% of the profits come from China. You look at Walmart. It's also down more than 20% of its high. It's now less than $70. It was at $90. Well, this is an economic indicator that tells you something about the economy.
Well, a lot, at least the bottom end of the economy is doing poorly for all the reasons you've mentioned, median household income weak. In fact, this has been a recovery of the numbers by the numbers and for the rich, mostly, at least in the U.S. So
the wealthy people, the asset owners, stock owners, property owners, especially apartment house owners, apartment building owners, they've done very well financially. But you have to ask yourself, how long can it last? When your customers are not doing well, your wealth eventually will also be called upon.
And so, you know, if I follow this thread through, we had a small corporate bond issue in 95. Greenspan opened up the floodgates, gave us a NASDAQ bubble that burst. Then we opened up the floodgates even more. We got a housing bubble that burst. Floodgates got opened up even more. But aren't all of these actually just symptoms of a credit bubble that started a long time? Isn't this really something that started?
Yes, of course we have a credit bubble, a gigantic credit bubble, and it's getting worse and worse. But you understand, if you print money, you can postpone things for a long time. You can't postpone it forever. Eventually, the system collapses. But will it collapse this year, next year, or in 3 years? We don't know for sure.
So spread your bets.
My bet is that basically it's not a time to play hero and be long assets on a leveraged basis. As I said, my bet is you and I and everybody else has no clue how the world will look like in 5 years' time. So, in my opinion, the best is probably to be diversified. It will not protect you 100%, but it will give you some safety net.
Well, there's a lot to diversify against. I don't know how to diversify all of it. You know, a while ago, geopolitically, very tense time with Russia.
Yeah, sure, I agree with you. And also, in the Western world, there is an increasing move towards socialism and towards the belief that maybe a wealth tax would be a very good idea. You understand? First, the central banks, through money printing, fatten the pigs. In other words, fatten rich people, including yourself and myself. And then they will not accept the blame for this wealth inequality increase. They will then turn around and say, well, the reason why the economy is doing so badly is that we have this zero, not 0.1%, not 1%, but 0.01% of people that have a hell of a lot of money. They are billionaires. And as a percent of their income, they don't spend much. So what we have to do is to take money from all these people and give it to the poor who have a high propensity to spend.
Well, I actually think that's coming. A couple of ways to do it. One is with socialist redistribution policies. The second would be for the Federal Reserve in cahoots with my U.S. government to, I don't know, cut me a tax rebate check for the last 2 years of taxes I paid, or in some way get money back. I think that's coming personally, and my advice to people is to run. Don't walk, run to spend that money as fast as you can, because it just, I don't know how that's different from what Venezuela has been doing.
Yeah, sure, I agree with you. But as I said, we don't know how far they will go, because politically there is now increasing criticism of the Fed. And in my view, increasingly, central banks are losing their credibility. So to what extent they can really do that, I'm not sure. This would also be my concern about owning gold. It's not unlikely that at some point Western central banks, because they all talk to each other, and the ECB is basically an ally of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the EU basically follows the instructions of the U.S., that they, if the U.S. moves to confiscate gold, and they will pay something for it, but they'll take it away, then that the EU would do the same, including the Swiss, I may add.
Well, yeah, it's been my concern seeing all the bail-in provisions that have swept across the G20, which says, okay, we want everybody in the banks and we want you to be our captive audience here. And then secondarily, the war on cash, you know, wanting everybody to...
It's an assault on people's freedom.
So it looks to me like, Mark, what they've done is they want everybody to share in whatever losses are coming, and they don't want any escape hatches. Sounds like you're saying that your concern is that gold will be viewed as an escape hatch. That door needs to be nailed shut.
Well, the point is that we had a colossal asset bull market, which began basically for equities and bonds. For bonds, 1981, September 81, with treasuries over 15% yield, and for equities, August 1982, with Dow Jones below 800. And at the same time, we had a huge bull market in all asset classes, whether these are vintage cars or art prizes or collectibles or real estate and so forth. And I think this huge asset inflation is going to come to an end. And all asset owners will be affected to a lesser or to a larger extent.
And so the safer assets in this course, since this is basically a credit bubble that we're not willing to voluntarily abandon, then you have to worry, in the words of von Mises, that there's a final catastrophe of the currency systems involved potentially.
Yes. I mean, the safest asset, in my opinion, is gold, provided you can hold on to it and it's not taken away from you. Because before, central banks and the neo-Keynesian who have hijacked economics away from the free market and think that they are now the central planners, before they admit defeat, they'll move on and will argue, oh, the problem is we haven't done enough. We have to do more. And I've just written about this. The problem with larger governments, more government spending, is you also get more regulation, and regulation stifles business. So under the neo-Keynesian policies and under the policies of the Fed, in my opinion, economic growth cannot pick up. It cannot pick up. But as long as it doesn't pick up, they will think they have to do more and more and more because they cannot admit defeat.
Of course not.
Have you ever encountered an academic who will admit that he's wrong? Never.
Well, Paul Krugman doesn't leave to mind. And unfortunately, they are academics. When I look at the FOMC committee, we've got Janet Yellen, a professor, and
they're either academics or they come out of Goldman Sachs
or lawyers. A bunch of them have JD degrees and they served on various committees. So you either get investment bankers, lawyers, or academics. What could go wrong, right?
Yes,
of course. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Mark. It's a pleasure as always.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And until next time, people can follow you on markfabersblog.com, on the news channels, of course. So again, thank you a lot.
Well, basically, I have a website, gloomboomdoom.com.
Gloomboomdoom.com. We'll link to that at the bottom of this with the transcript. Again, Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.